From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. Facebook's recent woes have prompted some critics to call for new government regulation. A North Carolina-based computer expert offers his thoughts. He weighs potential pros and cons of government involvement with the social media giant. The high-profile confirmation hearings for U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh helped shine a spotlight on North Carolina's junior U.S. senator. You'll hear from Tom Tillis. Charlotte served as the setting as the federal government unveiled a new program designed to help small business employees save for retirement. You'll learn details. Plus, you'll learn why North Carolina's price gouging law creates more problems than it solves. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Just over $2 billion sits in North Carolina's Rainy Day Fund. Essentially, that is the state's savings account to be used for emergencies or perhaps economic downturns, natural disasters, and such. Now, at times over the past few years, some have criticized the fiscally conservative lawmakers for building up this fund. But in the wake of Hurricane Florence, that criticism has now subsided. Joe Coletti is a senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He analyzes fiscal issues and is here to talk about the fund. Joe, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So it seems that there was a concentrated push to build up this fund over the past few years. Give us a sense of what occurred in the General Assembly that really led to all of this.
The Rainy Day Fund, or the Savings Reserve Account, as it was originally called, was created back in the 90s, late 90s. And the goal then was to get it up to 5%. It never
5% of what?
Oh, sorry, 5% of general fund spending the year before.
Okay.
So that just like you do with your own house, right? You want to have that. You want to set aside $1,000 or something like that to get so that you can get through something. And it never quite made it up to that once the first recession in 2000-2001 hit, and remained at very low levels throughout. And so when the latest recession in 2007 through 2009 came about, and it was just about depleted again. When the Republicans came into office in 2011, they said, we need to build this back up and we need to get it to a robust amount. And so just this past year, it was up over 8% of general fund spending, which it was the statutory goal before, up until that point. And the goal was to be able to, how do we get through the next recession without having to raise taxes and without having to cut back services? Because you have both sides that happen in an economic downturn, that your costs go up because you have to deal with Medicaid and you have to deal with all the other things, that all the other social services that become a greater need, at the same time that you're running out of that the revenues are falling down because people aren't earning money and they're not spending money. So that's what the goal of it was, and by being able to build it up to over $2 billion now, you can use it when a natural disaster hits. So 2 years ago, when Hurricane Matthew hit, there was $100 million that they were able to tap into, and that's what they were looking to do, and they're not done building that up because they're looking to increase the stability of that.
There's a very interesting chart that, by the way, is available at johnlock.org that shows over the years how the fund has grown. And definitely you see at about 2010-2011, you start to see what are clearly bigger and bigger deposits into this fund. You mentioned a statutory goal. Does that mean that there is a requirement each year in the operating budget that a certain amount be put into the fund, or is that really discretionary?
There's With the latest bill that was passed in 2017, almost unanimously, there was only one vote against it, and Governor Cooper signed it quickly. There is now a 15% of whatever the increase in revenue is from year to year goes into savings. And there is a – so that's in statute now. In the past, legislatures, when they've had huge surpluses, they had other requirements about so much money goes into it, and they used one of the greatest words of legislatures, notwithstanding, which says, you know, we said this, but now we really don't mean it.
But not really.
But this time, you know, with this legislature, that they tend to stick with what they've promised in terms of money. And so that part is set. And there's also now, through the Fiscal Research Division of the General Assembly and the Office of State Budget, they come up with taking a look back at the last few recessions and say, you know, to survive 90% of these without a tax increase or without excessive cuts, we should get this up to about 11% is what the target is now. It's not a firm that it has to reach that, but that's what the legislature is trying to get to now.
Joe, at the point that you and I are talking, at least, I have heard at least one state legislator mention the Rainy Day Fund, and we've heard a number of members of the U.S. congressional delegation, particularly in the affected areas of Fayetteville, Wilmington, et cetera, talk about tapping federal disaster funds and also looking to Governor Cooper to talk in the General Assembly to talk about this fund. Are you expecting that they will tap this fund?
I would think that given that 2 years ago, they took $100 million from it to provide immediate assistance to the affected areas. I would think that they'll come back sooner than they're scheduled to right now, because they're scheduled to be back at the end of November. I would expect them to come back in the next couple weeks to set aside $100 million or potentially more to help with immediate needs in the area, because this affected homes, this affected businesses, this affected the interstates, potentially affected railroads. There's a lot of damage and a lot of things that need to happen quickly, regardless of what happens with the federal money and regardless of all the great private efforts that are being raised.
What would they have to do in the legislature in order to move some of this money out? Is that a relatively easy, quick thing to do, or is it complicated?
They try to make it, you know, they try to make sure that there's a vote with it and a greater than majority. But it should be something, especially when you have a disaster like this, it should be relatively easy for them to be able to say, we're going to take some money and put it into the affected areas. And last time they had a plan to repay it within a year, and they did. And so I would expect something like that this will become an appropriation next year, but to be able to get that money. And that's part of what the purpose is that in the middle of the year, when you have something come up and you need to spend money, it's there for that. There's also in the budget that was passed about $500, $600 million of unappropriated, unreserved funds that they can use as well. So they may not need to go into the Rainy Day Fund. They may be able to just say, we had this money that we weren't going to appropriate. Part of the reason why you just have cash sitting on the table at the end of a budget is for something like this as well.
Everything you're describing, Joe, really leads me, and I would think our listeners, to understand that over the past few years, these fiscally conservative decisions that have been made by the leadership in the General Assembly are proving out to be important and very impactful to North Carolina.
Yeah, when you save money ahead of time, you don't have to borrow money in the future. It's a great and you can make decisions and help people when you have something that there does need to be help when only government can step in. And so if you reduce what you spend so that you're spending less than you take in, again, simple basic things that we figure out as families, it works the same way with the legislature.
And lastly, Joe, you mentioned something really interesting a few moments ago. You said something about the private efforts. We can't forget about that and leave that out of the story in this recovery and reaction to the devastation of Florence. So many private groups and individuals have stepped up to work in partnership with federal and state government and local government as well.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's always a reassuring thing to see, right? That, you know, the democracy works when we work together on our own, in addition to through our voting. And so that's one of the great things. You know, you hate to see this kind of thing happen, but it's reassuring to see our fellow North Carolinians and everybody across the country stepping up to be able to provide assistance.
We've been talking with Joe Coletti. He is senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He is a fiscal analyst. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org. Joe Coletti, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todayweb.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats, Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E, .org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Recent controversy surrounding Facebook and its users' data has prompted new questions about the social media giant. Our next guest recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society about Facebook, what it knows about you, with whom it shares that information, what you can do about it, and the prospect of more regulation. Bob Chandler is a technology expert. He is president of MacVantage Incorporated. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mitch.
So first of all, before we get into the regulation aspect, which will be most of this interview, Facebook's more than just a fun place to find out what your friends are up to. It really does collect a lot of information about people, doesn't it?
It does. Some of the information people willingly give to Facebook, others of it they try and figure out from what you do. And so Facebook has just a ton of information on you. First off, it knows things like your gender. It knows where you check in when you do different things. And also, it starts to try and figure out, okay, what's this person's race? What's their political beliefs? And then another thing that a lot of people don't realize is if you have it on your iPhone or on your Android phone, it will actually track your location using the phone. And so if you go in and look at the information Facebook has on you, they may have all these places that you've been, and they certainly have all the places that you checked in.
Well, because Facebook has all of that information, there has been some discussion now about regulation of Facebook. And what has been discussed on that front?
There's been different things have been talked about. The EU is doing a big privacy thing right now, so that's getting a lot of press. But on the United States side, some people have talked about having even a constitutional amendment about our right to privacy. But a lot of people have talked about should there be legislation saying, you know, what exactly can companies do with your information, and that they have to make it very explicit of what their policy is and give you ways to opt in or opt out of that policy.
Now, Facebook, like many other companies, may see the big hand of government stepping in with more regulation and say, oh, no, we don't want that. But you suggest that at least in this case, Facebook might be interested in regulation. Why?
That's right. They had Mark Zuckerberg, the president of Facebook. They called him up before Congress. And so he went and testified there. That was interesting in a lot of ways. One of the interesting ways was seeing how many senators really didn't understand what Facebook was. And some of them were not sure they know what the internet is. But those are the people that would be putting this regulation together. And so one of them, Lindsey Graham, asked Mark Zuckerberg, he said, would you be open to being regulated? And Mark Zuckerberg said, well, I think so, as long as it was the right kind of regulation. And so I thought to myself, what would be the right kind of regulation for Facebook? Well, what Facebook would like to do is they would like to have regulation that would prevent other companies from coming into their space. You know, maybe there's some regulations that you'd have to be a really huge company in order to afford to comply with those regulations. Well, a small startup, they couldn't do that. Also, Facebook talks about trying to put some artificial intelligence in place to track hate speech. Well, that's taken them a long time to develop, and they still aren't there yet. How could some small startup company be able to do those kinds of regulations? So in essence, what Facebook would like is barriers to entry to keep them, you know, on top.
We are chatting with Bob Chandler. He is president of MacVantage Incorporated. And I should note that he is the person who works with the computers for the John Locke Foundation, in addition to being a technology expert in general. Bob, is this something that's unusual for these larger tech companies, or have we been seeing this with the other companies as well, that once they get to be fairly large, they don't really mind as much when the government wants to step in?
I think it's something that we see kind of across all industries. Whenever somebody becomes the incumbent player, then they want to be able to keep other people out of their industry there. And so we've seen it some on the tech side, but this is one of the few times when I think people have really started to be concerned about what the tech companies are doing. In general, you know, when they're making computers or just making phones, they haven't been that interested in it. But now that all of a sudden their private information is being sold or being put out there, that's when people have started to really think about, is this something we'd like to have regulated? And I think Facebook has thought about, how could we take advantage of that?
Now, if there is no additional government regulation, are there good prospects for some competitor to come along and offer a product that might undercut Facebook's dominance? I mean, would regulation make a huge difference for Facebook in the long term?
I think part of the regulation would be closing the door after the horse is out. Do you have a MySpace account, Mitch?
No, never did.
Okay, well, MySpace, some of y'all will remember that, was a social media platform. It was one of the first ones. And so now no one's ever heard of that. And so Facebook, last year their ad revenues were up, but their visits were down. And so now a lot of people, I think, are moving to Twitter. And so Twitter is kind of taking on Facebook and some of the things that it used to do. And then the big thing now is Instagram. That's what all the kids are doing now. And so they refer to Facebook as the place where your grandparents are. And so Instagram now may be taking over. But one of the things to realize is Facebook owns Instagram.
And then there are Snapchat and other things
that's
I
right.
haven't even heard of. But it sounds as if in this regulation front, Facebook might be in the position of saying, please don't throw me in the briar patch,
that's
when
right.
all the time they would actually like something that would help preserve their business.
That's right. And also, whatever regulation the government does will be based on the current model. And so in one sense, that may actually entrench that model. So they say, oh, you have to do things this way and meet these regulations. That might prevent innovation that would allow things to be done a completely different way. Like Instagram is focused on photographs, whereas Facebook has been focused a lot, some on photographs, but a lot on just, you know, text messages coming in.
As someone who watches this industry very closely, and also as someone, as we could probably tell, is a fan of free market principles, is the best course of action here one that involves regulation, or would it be better to allow other competitors to try to take some of this market away from Facebook?
I do trust the market a lot and think that, okay, these things are fluid. You know, Facebook seems like it's huge and could never fall, but so did MySpace. And so I think that there will be competitive pressures in there and that different companies can come in. There may be a need overall for some legislation on privacy, though. Because I think privacy is now in a place where it can easily, you know, your information can be shared instantly across the whole world. There may be some role for government, but as far as I've seen from the senators and congressmen that have talked about it so far, I'm not sure they really understand the nuances that would make that effective.
So in the brief time that we have remaining, if there is some regulation, would you warn against allowing Facebook to play a very big role in helping to write the regulation?
Yes, I would hope that they're not the ones who are writing the regulation. But on the same token, I'm not sure I want many of those senators writing it either.
So perhaps getting some experts who don't have any skin in the game?
Yes, and I think, you know, a lot of the legislation is actually written by, you know, senators' aides and those sorts of people. And so I think there's probably a lot of those people that are really up on what's going on in the technology trends. But I think the industry needs input, but then also the public would need input as well.
Well, it's a very interesting topic. We know one person who's going to be watching very closely as this moves forward is Bob Chandler. He is a technology expert, especially on Mac computers, which is part of the name of his company. He is president of MacVantage Incorporated. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents. Their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats. Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlocke.org. That's johnlocke with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The recent U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh helped shine a spotlight on North Carolina's junior U.S. senator. Republican Tom Tillis chided his Democratic colleagues and liberal activists. Tillis asked why they were focusing on issues that had little to do with Kavanaugh's record on the bench.
We're talking about all this dark money and efforts going on the other side. Well, I just got an email from Organizing for Action. Y'all would know that as the legacy campaign of President Obama, telling me to oppose you because you're going to deny reproductive rights, deny health care coverage, advance climate change in a bad way, and end gun violence prevention. But I'm pretty sure once you get confirmed on the bench, you're not going to be able to file a bill to do any of that. What you may end up doing is finding out that we got lazy, we didn't work hard enough, we didn't understand the Constitution, we didn't reach across the aisle to create enduring value, which is largely the reasons why people get frustrated with you. They want you to do our job. Justice Gorsuch said numerous times in his confirmation hearing that I had the privilege of participating in, it's not my job to do your job, Mr. Senator. If you're frustrated and worried about the prospects of somebody being able denied coverage for pre-existing convictions, then let's fix it. That's why I filed a bill a couple of weeks ago. Let's fix it. don't play politics and blame the Supreme Court for your inadequate architecture of a bill. Let's fix it. If you're worried about the balls and strikes that Judge Kavanaugh has called on the bench around regulatory issues, it seems to me you've called balls and strikes on both sides of the Administrative Procedures Act. And there seem to be flaws in there that need to be fixed. For the attorneys in the room who are studied on the law, rather than trying to get Judge Kavanaugh to commit one way or the other on these policy initiatives that President Obama and others around this table are interested in, get him to explain to you the legal theory behind his position that may have, in fact, produced an outcome that he didn't particularly like, but because he did it based on his interpretation of the Constitution and the laws. Don't expect him to be a politician. And as for motivations, you know, I have to say that it's been said by at least one person on this committee that on the one hand, we shouldn't question other people's motivations. On the other hand, I find it personally insulting to think that because I think we have before us an eminently qualified judge, someone who's going to call balls and strikes to suggest that because I'm inclined to support them, that I'm complicit in evil, really makes me wonder the sincerity about questioning other people's motives.
That's U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. He's outlining some of his concerns about Democratic senators' approach to the U.S. Supreme Court nomination for Brett Kavanaugh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, friends, rivals, great American presidents, their ideas still have great value today. You can hear those ideas Monday, November 5th. It's a special living history event in Raleigh. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams come to life in a debate on the future of the United States of America. Taxes, trade, foreign threats, Jefferson and Adams dealt with them all. They'll hash out their differences before a live audience. You can join them. It's Living History, Monday, November 5th, 7 p.m. at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Tickets are $10, $5 for students. Buy tickets online at johnlock.org. That's johnlock with an E.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Charlotte served as the setting for the recent announcement of a new federal government plan. It's designed to help small business workers plan for retirement. U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has details.
Today's action by President Trump is designed to make it easier for Americans to channel some of that rich economic opportunity, not just into today, but into savings for their future. The President has asked the Department of Labor to consider expanding when employers, especially small and medium businesses, can band together to provide retirement plans. Now, these plans, in essence, 401ks, can include diversified investment options and automatic opt-out enrollment. 401k plans have a proven record. 401k plans have worked, and virtually all employees in large corporations have access to them. But there are about 42 million Americans, one-third of the private workforce, that doesn't work for a large corporation, but that works for a small business. And most of these small business employers can't provide access to the same quality 401ks. With so many Americans working for small businesses, and so many without access to workplace retirement plans, there's a real danger that today's economic opportunity will not translate into savings for the future.
Acosta asked his audience to consider the potential benefits.
Step back and imagine if all the small businesses here in Charlotte could band together and say, as a group, we're going to provide a retirement option for our employees, administered by one central entity, Chamber of Commerce, for example, who's represented up here today. Imagine the administrative savings, but also imagine the portability. When an employee goes from one small business to another small business, It's the same 401k plan, a portable 401k plan from small business to small business. You know, 401k plans are a straightforward, proven vehicle used by millions of Americans working for larger employers. If it works for them, there is no reason whatsoever that it should not work for employees of small businesses, too. Small business employees don't deserve to be forgotten simply because they don't have and don't get the same attention as the large corporations. They deserve access to retirement benefits. And if, as an association, chambers of commerce and others can start providing these retirement benefits, everyone will be better off.
North Carolina's Linda McMahon, head of the U.S. Small Business Administration, chimed in.
Today's executive order is a significant and important step toward increasing economic security for our American workers. It does that by reducing the regulatory hurdles that prevent millions of small businesses from providing workplace retirement plans. A significant percentage of small business owners and employees are not saving the money that they need for retirement. Have you ever seen that commercial on television where people are in front of the big graph and it says, where do you think you are relative to having enough retirement dollars? And few people hit that mark. With a 401k type of plan, a small business can not only provide a valued employee benefit, but also benefit from special tax incentives. And that's important for small businesses. As I traveled the country meeting with small business owners, and I've been to 44 states so far, I often hear they'd like to offer their employees retirement savings plans, but they just can't afford it. And the smaller the business, the more unlikely it is to be able to absorb the high costs inherent in administering employee retirement plans.
McMahon pointed to the likely benefits of the new federal government rules.
The multiple employer plans that Secretary Acosta has referred to will result in significantly more small businesses offering retirement savings plans to their employees. And the new plan will be implemented by simplifying regulations. Again, a hallmark of this presidency is simplifying and rolling back regulations. So we're going to roll them back. We're not going to introduce more. Small businesses are so important to our economy. They create 2 out of every 3 net new jobs in the private sector. And we want those entrepreneurs who take a risk on starting or growing a small business to know we're listening to you and the president has your back. And to America's workers, the new plan is a powerful message that we care about your financial security. We want you to take an active role in saving for your future, but you don't have to do it alone. Right now, only about half of private sector workers in places with fewer than 100 employees even have access to workplace retirement plans. This action is going to make it easier for you to save and to be able to share in the benefits of our growing economy.
Jerry Howard of the National Association of Home Builders praised the idea.
The men and women who house North Carolina are overwhelmingly small business people who work and live in the same communities. This initiative that you are about to sign will enable them to help their neighbors, their employees, to economic security and retirement. This initiative will help them compete against larger businesses in a very tight labor market, which is tight because of the success of your economy. And we're all grateful for that, but it is causing us a little bit of problems. But this initiative is going to help us out a lot, Mr. President. This initiative simply is good for business. It's good for employees. It's good for communities. It's good for the economy.
Bob Morgan of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce welcomed the announcement.
Small business is a big part of Charlotte's story. In fact, there are more than 50,000 small businesses, those with fewer than 20 employees, who call the Charlotte region home. A significant number of these businesses are not able to bear the cost and the regulatory burdens of offering 401k retirement benefits. Mr. President, companies in Charlotte, big, small, and in between, are already benefiting from the tax and regulatory relief that you have delivered to the American people. Your announcement today and the promotion of association retirement plans will, I predict, positively impact many of our small businesses and the thousands of people that they currently employ. And let me say, the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce would love to be the first local association to implement one of these new plans.
President Trump offered his own comments about the proposal.
I promise to put American workers first. I promise to put their families first. In fact, I promise to put their families even ahead of them. And most of them like it, and the ones that don't, we don't like them too much anyway, okay? But today I'm honoring that promise once more here in Charlotte. From our youngest citizens to our senior citizens, we're truly making America great again.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent presidential announcement in Charlotte. The federal government plans to make it easier for workers in small businesses to save for retirement. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The images of devastation and the stories of families displaced from their homes due to Hurricane Florence are absolutely heartbreaking. But in the wake of the storm, Governor Roy Cooper served notice that the state would not allow what he called price gouging from those selling in-demand products, things like ice gas, for example, or in-demand services such as repair and debris removal. But our next guest says that the price gouging provision is actually misguided and that it hurts people. He's here to explain why. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. Roy, welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be back, Donna.
So no one's heart cannot break, frankly, when you see right. what has occurred in our state and these different areas, and people are needing so many things.
Right.
And no doubt that the motivation and the intention of those who don't want people to be scammed is coming from their heart. But you're looking at the economics of mm-hmm. this, and that's what this is really about. You actually say that this is misguided. It hurts people. Why?
Well, let me just clear something up. Price gouging is not scamming. Okay. Scamming is fraud. No one's defrauding people. What they call price gouging, which really isn't an economic term, it's just charging the market price. Okay. And the reason why you want people to be able to charge the market price, where supply equals demand in economics terms, is for social reasons. Okay. What do you want in such a situation? You want people to conserve whatever it is they want to use. You want producers, sellers, to get more stuff to sell. Okay. So you want more supply, less demand. You want people to conserve, and you want people not to hoard. Okay.
The topping off of the gas tank.
Having three cars in your driveway going nowhere, all with tanks full of gas while the tanks at the pump are empty. This is the kind of thing that is encouraged by these laws, which keep prices from rising to the market price, the so-called gouging price. Because what the higher price does is it makes people think, do I really need to have that third car full of gas in my driveway that's just going to sit there? It makes you consider your your decisions and discourages hoarding, because that's what that is. You don't want, you want the available to supply to be out there for example, emergencies. The woman who has to get to the hospital, right? But can't get to the hospital to deliver her baby, but can't get gas because they're either out or there's a line around the block that's 2 hours long. So, the higher prices encourage socially beneficial behavior. The forced lower prices discourage all that. And one thing I left out is the higher prices encourages, because it means a higher profit margin for the sellers. It encourages new supply to come into the area. Supplies will move from areas of lower profit to higher profit, which reduces the price, right?
Exactly. So in your example, then, instead of people having the full gas tanks for three vehicles that are sitting in the driveway going nowhere, if fewer people say, no, that price is too high for me, I'm just not willing to pay that, enough people start to do that. That's the market signal that brings the price down.
But not only that, it brings in more supply. A great example is from Fran. 2 decades ago now, where in Raleigh there was no ice, okay, and some college students from Goldsboro, where there was plenty of ice, decided we're going to rent an ice truck, we're going to fill it full of ice, go to downtown Raleigh and sell ice on the street corner, right? They were selling it, ice $10-$11 a bag, okay, but what they could get it, there was a long line to buy that ice. $10-$11 a bag earned them a profit, encouraged them to bring in more supply, right? Exactly what that higher price is supposed to do, right? Increase the supply of ice. That's what it did. Well, the police came along and shut them down, and my understanding is that the people waiting in line to buy gas at $10-$11 a bag actually cheered. I don't quite understand, because the police were denying them their right to buy something, which just seems bizarre, but... the point is that it encouraged, that higher price encouraged the additional supply. And you would see that in lots of areas. Why would someone bring more supply in, let's say, from Virginia to North Carolina, if they can't sell it for any more, right?
Well, you've talked about and you've written about the state's law that allows this, the provision that allows the governor to say, okay, the so-called price gouging law is now in effect. Mm-hmm. What does it really say? And I mean, who gets to determine what is the situation where we're going to impose this price control?
Well, first of all, it doesn't even have to be a natural disaster in our own state. For example, the law now says, it used to be that it had to be a disaster in our own state. The law now says that you can trigger the price gouging law if it's a disaster, let's say in Texas, that disrupts gasoline supply to North Carolina. So a hurricane in Texas could trigger that law in North Carolina, and has. The rules are very complicated, and I don't know them real well. I mean, it has to do with what you have been charging for the last 60 days, which is irrelevant, by the way, to what you charge now, right? Supply and demand shifts all the time. The whole point here is that what you charged 60 days ago has nothing to do with what the price should be now, right? Demand and supply have moved in such a direction where price is going to rise. You have less supply, more demand, because people are trying to hoard. And the price is not allowed to respond to that. So what you charged yesterday is irrelevant to what you charge today. Supply and demand is always shifting, and prices need to follow that in order to, what economists say, coordinate the market, to basically bring people's plans together. Otherwise, you end up with these crazy situations where gas stations are closed, people waiting in long lines for hours to get gas. You have the 1970s, right? If those of you out there who are young, you don't remember the 1970s, just look at the lines and so on that occur in North Carolina whenever we have one of these programs. This is what they were like. And for the exact same reason, we had price controls on gasoline and oil at the time, which is what caused those shortages. And it's the exact same principle.
How serious is it if someone violates the price gouging provision? I mean, as you and I are talking, I've been reading about reports where there's like a hotline and people are calling in and reporting people because they think that they're charging too much for something.
And the simple thing to do is just don't buy it, right? I mean, but there are heavy fines and people – store owners would rather keep the price low, of course, run out. Sit, you know, just sell until it's gone, shut their doors, and go home, right? Mm-hmm. Sit through the hurricane at home rather than working through it.
But we want them to be
selling. Exactly.
Product, service,
but what does it do? It encourages them to keep the price at the low price, the price that is not consistent with market, until they run out. And cap their pumps and shut their doors and go home. And this is what happens.
So, Roy, what do we do? Or what can someone like you, an economist, say to people that essentially gets them to not listen to what is, I think, a natural reaction from someone who's in a really tough situation? That is to want to go out, top off the gas tank, buy as much ice as you can. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
Well, what I say to them is, would you rather have these products available at a higher price or not available at a lower price? In other words, you can find places with $2.59 a gallon on their sign, except they don't have any to sell you at that price.
We've been talking with Roy Cordato. He is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.